Section 4. Going forth. Between my taking counsel from Utitila and my going forth, there was an interval of more than 3 years. During that period, the signals unit to which I belonged had been ordered overseas. I had been stationed in Delhi, Colombo, Calcutta, and Singapore, had made contact with Chinese and Sinhalese Buddhists, had returned to India, for good, as I then thought, had been associated with various religious organizations and groups, both Buddhist and Hindu, and had taken up the regular practice of meditation. Now I was ready to enter upon the next of the various stages by which the meaning, the significance, and the importance of going for refuge became clear to me. And accordingly, on the 18th of August, 1947, 3 days after the Union Jack ceased to flutter over the Indian subcontinent, and 8 days before my 22nd birthday, in Kasauli in East Punjab, I renounced the household life and went forth into the life of homelessness. The immediate cause of my taking this drastic step was disillusionment with worldly life, especially with worldly life as represented by organized religion. Together with the Bengali friend with whom, on my return to India, I had joined forces, I had worked for the Ramakrishna Mission Institute of Culture and for the Mahabodhi Society. More recently, I had been involved in a project for the revival of the Dharma Vijaya Vahini, an organization for the propagation of Buddhism in India that had been started many years earlier by an old scholar whom I happened to meet at an inter-religious gathering in Ahmedabad. With all these organizations, as well as with the group that had formed around a well-known female ascetic, I had been deeply disappointed, as had my friend. Working with such bodies was, it seemed, a hindrance rather than a help to spiritual development. They had a natural tendency to degenerate, and the only course open to us was to sever our connection, not just with them, but with the world. As related in that portion of my memoirs which was published in 1976 as The Thousand-Petaled Lotus, we therefore dyed our clothes, the traditional ochre, disposed of our worldly possessions, said goodbye to our friends, and the following morning, the morning of the 18th, set out on foot down the road that led from Kasauli to the plains. In going forth in this way, we were, of course, following an ancient Indian tradition, a tradition which the Buddha himself had followed some 25 centuries earlier. Indeed, both before and after my companion and I took our plunge into the ocean of the spiritual life, instead of sitting hesitating on the shore, to vary the metaphor, I was very conscious that in exchanging the household life for the life of homelessness, we were following the personal example of the Buddha, as well as that of many of his closest followers. And the consciousness that we were so doing inspired and uplifted me. The Buddha's own going forth had terminated at the foot of the Bodhi tree, when he attained the supreme enlightenment that, for the last 6 years, had been the object of his noble quest. So far as his followers were concerned, i.e. those of them who had gone forth, either before meeting him or after going for refuge to the Three Jewels as a result of hearing his teaching, some attained enlightenment while others did not, depending on how faithfully they had followed the path he had shown. As time went on, and especially after the Buddha's parinirvana, or great decease, going for refuge, going forth, and even becoming a monk in the later, narrow, more formalistic sense, came to be more and more closely identified. Just as the Sangha or spiritual community and the monastic order came to be more and more closely identified. The story of how this happened is a long one, and I have no time to tell it now. I mention the matter at all only because I want to make the point that at this stage in the history of my going for refuge, I had not sorted these things out. Despite having taken pencil from Utitila, I had not realized that going for refuge was the central and decisive, indeed the definitive act of the Buddhist life. One did not go for refuge because one was a Buddhist, but was a Buddhist because one went for refuge. And that going forth and becoming a monk were spiritually of significance and value only to the extent that they were expressions of one's going for refuge. I had not realized that going forth, far from being simply a matter of renouncing the whole household life, in fact consisted in the emergence of the individual, in the sense of the self-aware, emotionally positive and responsible human being, to name only a few of his or her characteristic qualities from the matrix of group or merely collective existence. Because I did not realize this latter point, for me, as for many Eastern Buddhists, the next step after going forth, which in any case had been formalized as shramanera or novice ordination, consisted not, as it should really have done, in finding and being accepted into a spiritual community of those who had both gone for refuge and gone forth, so much as in taking bhikshu ordination, and in this way entering into full membership of the monastic order. Thus, it was not surprising that my companion and I, having gone forth, should not only want to study Buddhism, but should also want to take ordination as bhikshus. Our original plan had been to study and, if possible, to take ordination in Ceylon. And on reaching Delhi, we had accordingly lost no time in heading south. On our arrival in Colombo, however, we were refused entry into Ceylon and were forced to return to South India, where, after some interesting adventures, we eventually settled in a deserted ashram on the outskirts of the town of Muwattupura, in the state of Travancore, where we stayed for 15 months. Looking back over the years, it is difficult not to feel that the failure of our original plan was in fact an instance of the proverbial blessing in disguise, since it is extremely unlikely that we should have found in Ceylon the right conditions for our spiritual development. During the period of our stay at Muwattupura, the greater part of my time was spent in study, meditation, and reflection. And in this way, I came to have a clearer understanding of the Dharma, especially of the Dharma as represented by the teachings of dependent origination, conditioned co-production, the Four Noble Truths, and the Three Characteristics of Conditioned Existence, as well as a keener awareness of the fact that I was a Buddhist. This keener awareness of my spiritual identity, as it may be termed, was due in part at least to the fact that throughout our stay in South India, I was surrounded by Hindus of various castes and sects. The few Indian Christians did not really count, and had no contact with Buddhists whatever. For my companion, though in some respects appreciative of Buddhism, was by birth a Brahmin and had not yet completely freed himself from his Hindu conditioning. Indeed, I had had no contact with Buddhists of any kind since my departure from the Mahabodhi Society nearly 2 years earlier. Despite this prolonged spiritual isolation, however, my allegiance to Buddhism remained unshaken. If anything, it was more firmly and deeply rooted than ever, so that by the time our stay in Muwattupura came to an end, I was again thinking of ordination, and thinking of it more seriously than ever, as indeed was my companion. Nevertheless, though I was again thinking of ordination, I still thought of it not in terms of finding and being accepted into a spiritual community, but in terms of taking bhikshu ordination and joining the monastic order. In other words, I had not understood that for the Buddhist at least, the act of going forth was a transition from group or merely collective existence, as represented by the household life, to supra-collective but associated existence, as represented by the spiritual community. I had not understood this because I did not, at this stage, have a clear understanding of the difference between the group, consisting of those who are merely group members, and the spiritual community, consisting of those who are individuals in the sense I have indicated. Because I did not have a clear understanding of this vitally important difference, I was unable to envisage the possibility that in becoming a monk and joining a monastic order, I might become not a member of a spiritual community, but only a member of another kind of group, not a secular group, but a religious or even an ecclesiastical group. For my failure to understand the difference between the group and the spiritual community, the group member and the individual, I was not altogether to blame. For, as I came to appreciate only years later, it was a failure common to virtually the whole Buddhist world, many parts of which were sunk in monastic or pseudo-monastic formalism of an extreme kind. As I trace the early stages of this history of my going for refuge, therefore, I must be careful not to be too hard on my younger and less experienced self, and careful not to expect too much of him. More important still, I must be careful lest I forget or lose touch with or even start underestimating the mood of spiritual exaltation with which I renounced the household life and went forth into the homeless life. Our past selves underlie our present self, even as the catacombs underlie modern Rome. Or rather, they live on in our present self, and in a sense actually form a part of it. This is certainly the case with my going forth in Kosali and the period of seclusion at Muratapura that followed. Indeed, despite the fact that I did not, at the time, understand the full significance of the step I was taking, I regard my going forth as being not only one of the most important stages in the history of my going for refuge, but one of the principal turning points of my life. For this reason, when I realized last year that the 40th anniversary of my going forth was approaching, I could not help feeling I would like to commemorate the occasion in some way, if only by preparing a paper in which I would recall my going forth and reflect on its significance. This did not prove practicable. I was still recovering from the effects of the operations I had undergone earlier in the year, besides being busy with the women's ordination retreat and the various order conventions. When the 18th of August came, I found myself, most appropriately, at Guhyaloka, where I quietly celebrated the day, more or less, on my own account. As I sat on the veranda of my bungalow, looking out over the bright green pine trees of our magical valley, at the wall of grey rock immediately opposite, there flashed on my inward eye the small hill station in distant India, and my saffron-clad, 22-year-old self, going forth on that fateful morning all those years ago. And I mused on the step I had taken and on the consequences it had had for myself and others. One of the thoughts that occurred to me as I sat there in the sunshine was that experiences like taking pansil and going forth were more than just stages in the long process of discovery, whereby the meaning and significance of going for refuge had gradually become clear to me. Each stage also possessed, quite apart from that process, an independent value and significance that ought to be appreciated for its own sake. But I have no time to pursue the implications of this idea, or to consider its bearing on the actual discovery process, to the next stage of which I must now turn.